Well, last week I gave you some homework. How'd you do? Today I want you to turn in your homework so I can grade it. Remember, last week we were looking at Jesus' prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. And one of the things I did was I challenged you to spend one full hour straight through in prayer this week. And I'm just curious, how many of you did your homework? Raise your hand if you did your homework. That's pretty good. That looks like about 10%. So the rest of you have another week to do that. And I did it this week, and, you know, I found actually, I thought it was going to, you know, just be such agonizing pain, and I really just found that the time went by so quickly, and I felt so refreshed and encouraged in the Lord after spending that time. And so I'm just so glad that I did, and I encourage you to do it as well. And I have to tell you that I received some really encouraging emails this week from some of you who did that. And I received permission from a couple of them to read to you what they got out of that experience. One person wrote this: "For the first time in my entire life, on Monday morning, I prayed for an entire hour. I was awake and on my knees, or sitting, I'm getting older, you know, for the full hour. I assumed that since Jesus' prayer in the garden is recorded for us, somebody must have heard it, which implies that he was speaking out loud. This consideration is what made it work for me. I modeled my conversation with God after those that I have with my friends and family. If I can talk to them for an hour or more, why can't I talk to God that way? I was so touched and impacted by my time with the Lord that I made time to do it again on Tuesday, early in the morning, on my business trip this week." Isn't that great? Someone else wrote this: "After about 5 minutes of the same thing that I'd been going over and over and over with him, I remembered how you said, just be truthful with God and tell him what you're thinking. I started doing that, and right away, God revealed to me that I had a bad attitude problem and was very bitter about things. He showed me that until I could trust him to take care of my finances and just lay myself open to his will, I would never have peace. He showed me that I was taking my bitterness out on those closest to me, and I didn't even realize it. He showed me that I've never asked him what he wants me to do for a job because I was afraid that he would lead me into something that I really didn't want to do. For me, it was like the light turned on. It's become so clear." I'm sure that some of you who also took that challenge this week could tell perhaps some of your own stories of how the Lord met with you in that time. It's amazing to me how prayer can steady us in some of the darkest moments of our life. It's amazing to me how oftentimes during those prayer times, God brings to light things in our own life that we need to realize. Remember what we said last week? We talked about how prayer changes us more than it changes God. I believe this is important for us to understand as we look at the next scene in Luke's gospel. Now, if you have a Bible, turn to Luke chapter 22. In this next scene, we see the arrest of Jesus Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane. And no doubt this had to be one of the darkest moments of Jesus' life. And it probably seemed on the surface from a human perspective like everything was completely out of control. You ever feel like that? You ever feel like things are just kind of spinning out of control? Things are happening so fast, kind of like a domino effect, and you can't seem to stop them? H.G. Wells once said that the world is like a great stage production and it's directed and managed by God. And he says that as the curtain rises, the set is perfect and everything goes well until the leading man steps on the hem of the leading lady's dress, causing her to trip over a chair, which knocks over a lamp, which pushes a table into the wall and causes the scenery to come knocking down, which brings everything down on the actors' heads. Meanwhile, as Wells puts it, behind the scenes, God, the director, is running around, shouting orders in a panic, pulling strings, trying desperately to restore order to the chaos. And yet, as Wells says, he can't do it because he's very limited. God can only do so much, you know. Now, when you look at this scene in the Garden of Gethsemane from one perspective, it almost seems like what Wells describes is the case. When you look at the various ways the main characters in this scene are acting, it kind of does seem like everything is spinning out of control. Listen as I read, starting in Luke 22, verse 47. Luke 22, 47. While Jesus was still speaking, behold, a crowd came. And the one called Judas, one of the 12, was preceding them. And he approached Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said to him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? When those who were around him saw what was going to happen, they said, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? And one of them struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his right ear. But Jesus answered and said, stop, no more of this. And he touched his ear and healed him. Then Jesus said to the chief priests and officers of the temple and elders who had come against him, have you come out with swords and clubs as you would against a robber? While I was with you daily in the temple, you did not lay hands on me. But this hour and the power of darkness are yours. Now, there are three things that I want you to see in this scene that, again, at least on the surface, make it appear to us that things have really gotten out of control here. The first thing I want you to see is treachery. While Jesus is still speaking to his disciples in the garden, remember they had fallen asleep, and Jesus said, pray lest you enter into temptation. And while Jesus is still talking to them, Luke tells us that a crowd comes led by one called Judas, one of the 12. It's a very interesting way to refer to him, isn't it? It's kind of like Luke wants to isolate Judas and accentuate his betrayal as one of the 12. It's like the camera zooms in on Judas. And notice that Luke doesn't actually tell us that Judas kissed Jesus. I think Luke could hardly bear to describe it. But we know that Judas did kiss him. The other gospel writers tell us that. As a matter of fact, Mark in his gospel even tells us that Judas gave him a prolonged kiss. Now, we know that a kiss in any culture is a sign of intimacy, oftentimes of brotherly love and warm greetings. Betrayal is bad enough, but to use it as a sign of treachery, to use something as a sign of treachery, which expresses intimacy, like a kiss, which expresses trust and brotherly love, like a kiss, that's doubly despicable and painful. Sometimes we think that none of this really affected Jesus that much, that he knew Judas all along was the betrayer. And since Jesus never really trusted him in the first place, it didn't really hurt Jesus when Judas finally betrayed him. I have to tell you, I don't buy that at all. I believe Jesus was cut deeply by the double-edged knife of not just betrayal, but so much worse, betrayal with a kiss. Betrayal by one pretending to be a trusted friend. Now, if you've ever been betrayed by someone that you trusted, someone who all the while pretended to be your best friend, you know exactly how this feels. I think of different ways this happens in today's world. I can hardly bring myself to describe them. But I think of a child who is sexually abused by a trusted parent, a grandparent, or a trusted adult like a pastor even, or a coach. Talk about the kiss of betrayal. That's the worst kind. Or I think of men who shower their wives with flowers and gifts all the while seeing another woman on the side. Or I think of a company president who honors an employee of 35 years with a gold watch and a chicken dinner, all the while easing him out of his job. This kind of deceptive betrayal happens all the time in our society. I don't think any of us can get through life without it happening to us at least once. None of us is immune to this. And because of that, one of the things that we often try to do in our humanity is try to protect ourselves from being hurt. And so really what happens is that we refuse to really entrust ourselves to anyone. So we go through life and we might be the nicest person in the world on the surface, but we really won't let anyone get all that close to us. Because in the end, we've found that's the surest way to pain. So we have painless yet superficial relationships. And I believe a lot of us live that way, but we don't even know it. Until somehow we begin to peel away the calluses that are layered over our heart and face the pain. The one thing we have to keep in mind is that Jesus really understands this pain. Jesus has really been through it. The one you pray to, the one that you try to follow and obey, he knows the sting of betrayal by a trusted friend, and he knows the added pain of having his betrayer shower him with affection while he stabs him in the back. So you can talk to him about it because he knows. And he can help you work through it. And he can help you begin the healing process as you face the pain of your betrayal. So the first sign we see in this scene is that things are out of control is treachery. The second thing we see here is something that we see actually in the rest of the disciples, in Jesus' friends. It's fear. So we move from the kiss to the sword. The disciples are frightened. So they ask Jesus if they should draw their swords. Now, we know from an earlier conversation, remember that they had that same night with Jesus, that they had two swords. And they still had them. So they have these two swords. And so they're thinking, hey man, let's go for it. Let's use them. And I love this. I love how they ask Jesus, shall we use them now? Shall we do this? But then before he can even answer, one of them draws a sword and with great determination, yet poor aim, whacks off the right ear of one of the high priest's servants. Now we know, of course, that it was guess who? Who was it? Who did that? Peter did that. And this is such a Peter thing to do. Some of us are like that. You know, we're constantly taking the foot out of the mouth or whatever. But, you know, I was thinking about this. It's a good thing for this poor servant that Peter's sport was fishing rather than fencing, you know, because Peter, no doubt, was aiming to split that guy's head right in two. I mean, he wanted to kill him. He was going for the middle of his head and he just whacked off his ear instead. Now, we laugh at Peter now, but you got to remember that his impulsivity, which came out of fear, was dangerously stupid. Think about what he was doing here. Think about the results of what he was doing. He was playing perfectly now into the hands of the chief priests who had come to arrest Jesus. Now they could claim Jesus and his friends were not only resisting arrest, but planning some kind of guerrilla action against the authorities. So Peter, in his trying to do something good, trying to defend the Lord, if you will, validates the actions of those who are trying to do harm to Jesus. That's so often how it is when we try to do God's work in our way. You know, we try to help God out a little bit. And that's always what happens. Fear manifests itself in different ways in different people's lives. Some people retreat when they're frightened. They run. They go in the opposite direction. But sometimes we lash out, don't we? We pull our sword, in a sense, like Peter did. We take matters into our own hands. We panic and we think that if we don't do something to defend ourselves and fix the situation, we're going to get hurt. And by the way, the worst possible examples of this are when God's people try to get God's work done using the weapons of violence. It's always a disaster. Whenever God's people have taken up the sword to accomplish God's purpose, damage is done to God's plan. Someone's ear gets lopped off in the name of Jesus, and we're standing there with blood on one hand and a Bible in the other. And it doesn't work. I can't help but think that if Peter had only done what Jesus had told him to do in the garden, Jesus said, pray so that you may not enter into temptation. But Peter hadn't prayed. Peter had taken a nap. And so he wasn't ready when temptation struck. Human nature, unprepared by prayer, will get us into a ton of trouble. So we've seen treachery and we've seen fear. And the third thing now we see in this passage as an indication that things are out of control is hatred. Just raw hatred. The chief priests and the officers of the temple, this is the temple guard, and the elders, they come with swords and clubs to arrest Jesus like he were a member of the 10 most wanted list. They could have arrested him any time that week, in the daytime, in the temple. Remember Luke told us, in the daytime he taught in the temple, in the nighttime he went out to the Mount of Olives and slept. So he was teaching all day long in the temple, but they didn't come get him in the temple. They came and got him in the dark of night, and which obviously reveals, betrays their motives. If it was the right thing to do to arrest him, come in the daytime, Jesus says. But instead, they come in the dark of night, indicating how outside the realm of justice they really were. When I was a kid, we used to spend part of our summers up in the Sierra Nevadas. And my father and my brother and I, we would fish up and down the North Fork of the Yuba River. And those were great times. And I remember that my father, oftentimes early in the morning at the crack of dawn, would send my brother and I out along the shore of the Yuba. And it's very rocky, lots of big rocks and stuff. And so we'd be kind of walking along the rocks. And he would always send us out there to get live bait, literally to get these things called helgramites. That we could use for fishing, because those were the best thing to catch these rainbow trout. And so my brother and I would go out there with a little jars in hand, you know. And the way you got the thing is about helgramites is they hated the light. They hated the light. And so to find a helgramite, you would have to really quickly, you'd have to lift over a rock on its underside. And as soon as you would do that, oftentimes you would see all these little helgramites scramble. And they hated the light. And they would always just scramble for the dark. And so you had to be real quick. If you want to get one of the little buggers, you got to, boom, you got to go right for it. And it's interesting because that's how we are. That's how people are. On one occasion early in his ministry, listen to what Jesus said. He said, this is the judgment, that the light has come into the world and men loved the darkness rather than the light, for their deeds were evil. For everyone who does evil hates the light and does not come to the light, for fear that his deeds will be exposed. One of the most powerful memories I personally have of becoming a Christian was the feeling that I no longer had to hide. That is such a great feeling. Because for so long, I had lived basically with the fear of things that I had kept hidden in the dark. And there was always that fear that I would get caught. I would get caught by my teachers or my parents or the police or my friends or somebody. My deeds would be exposed to the light. And that's a burden to bear, to have to hide constantly. But now there was nothing in my life, I realized, that had not been exposed to God. And there was great, great freedom in that. Isn't it interesting, too, here how the ones who look the best on the outside are oftentimes the ones who are hiding the most. I mean, right here, these respected members of the clergy pretend to be serving the purposes of God. But the fact that they have to do their work under the cover of darkness, again, betrays their true motives. So we've seen here in this scene, then, treachery, fear, and hatred. And this is how people act when things are out of control. The question is, what about God? What about God? Is God like that panicked director whose set has fallen apart and he's just trying to do something to restore order to the chaos? Well, look again at this scene. I want you to look specifically again at Jesus Christ in this scene, because we know that Jesus Christ reveals to us God. This is God. And there's no panic here. When you look at Jesus Christ in this scene in the garden, There is absolute calm. He is deliberate and he is in control. And we wonder, how can Jesus be this way at that moment? How could he not just melt? I believe the key for all this, of course, a big part of it is what he had just got done doing, which is what? Praying. But I believe a huge key to all this in his thinking is what he says to the religious leaders down in verse 53. Down in verse 53, he says something very interesting to them, and I want you to underline it. He says, this hour and the power of darkness, or the domain of darkness, in a sense, the kingdom of darkness, are yours. So get this now. Jesus understood that there was more going on in this scene than what he could see with human eyes. There was more than just treachery, fear, and hatred on a human level. The power of darkness lay behind this human activity. It's almost like Jesus is saying, listen, you're doing what you're doing, but I want you to know this is hell's hour. This is hell's hour. That's what it is. And notice Jesus recognizes the battle is not a human battle. It's a battle with cosmic proportions. It's not a human battle, and so you do not fight it with human weapons like swords. When things seem out of control in your life, remember what you're dealing with. And I believe one of the key things that we have to do as believers is see beyond what we see with our human eyes and see deeper and realize that there's a spiritual battle going on here. We're dealing with the powers of darkness, if you will. Remember what Paul said to the Ephesians? He said, for our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, same word, by the way, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Now, Jesus understood that. He models that right here. And if we're going to respond like him, one of the things we have to understand is we have to see that. We have to see through the human to what is really going on a spiritual level. And by the way, that's not the only time Paul talked about that. Paul wrote to the Colossians. And listen to what he said. He said, for he, that is God, delivered us from the domain of darkness. There it is. The power of darkness. He delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom or the domain of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. Now that's good news, because that tells us that you and I in Christ are no longer ruled by the powers of darkness. See, we're under a new rule, the rule of God. And why is that? How could that happen? Here's the key. Here's the secret. Because hell's hour actually would become heaven's hour. Now, I know some of you are really scratching your heads. You're going, what's he talking about? Well, track me for a minute. Remember back in verse 14? Same chapter. Jesus is about to eat the Passover meal with his disciples. Luke says something very interesting. Luke says, when the hour had come, when the hour had come, he reclined at table and his disciples with him. When the hour had come. Here Jesus says, this hour is yours. The power of darkness, it's yours. But Luke refers to another hour. And throughout his ministry, Jesus often would say, it's not my hour yet. It's not my hour. My hour is coming. He always talked about the hour. What hour? The hour destined for him to suffer and die. We know that it was the Father's plan for him to die on the cross, because it was through the cross that you and I would be delivered from the domain of darkness. So Jesus, now get this, Jesus could remain calm because he knew the powers of darkness were actually being used by God to bring salvation to the world. So hell's hour really is heaven's hour. Without knowing it, Satan, get this, The devil was God's stage manager. And everything Satan choreographed for Christ to destroy him and us was actually a step towards our salvation. It's amazing. And you know what? The conviction that Jesus had about that is revealed, is manifest in how he operates there in this scene. Because look how Jesus deals with those around him. This does not reveal a man out of control. Look at how he deals with Judas. Despite the worst kind of betrayal, I believe Jesus is reaching out to Judas, even in the garden. Some people think, well, Jesus had just written Judas off, as we would have. But to the end, Jesus is inviting Judas to repent. When he asks, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? By the way, the Son of Man means the Messiah. Are you betraying the Messiah with a kiss? What is he saying? He's saying, Judas, why would you choose such a sign to betray me? Are you so cold, Judas, so beyond feeling that you would use a kiss? So with great passion and yet calmness, he sets before Judas the hideousness of his act so as to keep him from ruin. We have to ask the question, how can we possibly reach out like Jesus did to those who would betray us, even with a kiss? It helps us, of course, to understand that people are operating under the domain of darkness. And yet, the Lord is still reaching out to them. Just as he reached out to you when you were under the domain of darkness, when you were in the same condition. So God is at work. Now get this. God is at work even in the lives of those who betray us. And knowing that can help us reach out to them. I have a friend who likes to say that God is always working on both sides of the fence. You know how you have issues with people? And you're on this side of the fence? And they're on that side of the fence? And you guys, you just can't meet somewhere on the fence, you know? And you got just big issues, and you're sure that you're right, and you're sure that they're wrong, and, you know, that's the way it is, and we're going to never meet over this, and we're going to never make it right, and you know what? You know, God, just get them, would you? That's a great prayer, by the way. I use it all the time. Just get them. Anyway, that's a 9-year-old prayer. Just get them. But you know what? God's at work on both sides of the fence. You know that? Whether you're right or wrong, he's at work on that side of the fence too. And that's what Jesus understood. And that's what allowed him to reach out to someone on the other side of the fence. In his book, Unexpected Blessings, Cameron Lee includes a story that, true story, of course, that is told by a friend of his. I want to read it. It's a little long, but I think you'll see why it's important. He says, during the third month of my sister's life, she became very ill with pneumonia. My parents took her to the hospital and had her placed inside an incubator. The doctor monitored her for several hours and then sent her home with a prescription. The next morning, my father was suddenly awakened by the uncomfortable realization that he had slept through the entire night without any interruptions from my sister. He jumped out of bed and ran to check on the baby. The only thing he could remember of that horrific morning was lifting the tiny limp body and shaking it in order to feel it move. But it laid in his arms, motionless and dead. The medication prescribed to my sister was too strong for her, which caused her to lose control of all her muscles. Several of our relatives suggested that my parents sue the doctor. However, after much consideration, prayer, and advice from my grandparents, they decided not to take legal action. Rather, they received the conviction from God that they needed to forgive the doctor and express that to her in letter form. According to my mother, this was the most difficult thing for her to do. Yet after obeying the Lord, she felt an overwhelming sense of freedom and peace within her heart. For months following the death of my sister, four months after, I became incredibly ill with pneumonia. The doctor who had been in charge of my sister asked my father if he would allow her to take on my case. Everyone was completely flabbergasted. He said he needed some time to think it over. As my parents went to the Lord in prayer, they were convicted that this was an ultimate test of their forgiveness. They felt an overwhelming sense of peace that God was in control and that this would eventually become a powerful testimony. They agreed to let the doctor take on my case. The next few days were incredibly tense and filled with many moments of anxiety. However, by the fifth day, I had come out of intensive care and was on my way to full recovery. On the day of my discharge, the doctor pulled my father and mother aside, and with tears running down her face, she expressed sincere gratitude for the forgiveness and the grace they had extended to her. That story shows us that reaching out to someone on the other side of the fence, someone that we feel has betrayed us, oftentimes initially is done, let's be honest, as just a sheer act of obedience. We don't do it because we feel like it, but because God tells us to do it. But when he tells us to do something, he also gives us the grace to do it. And that's what those parents displayed. And I believe that's what Jesus displays here. Having surrendered in prayer and knowing that hell's hour would become heaven's hour, he was able to reach out to the other side of the fence to his betrayer. This also allowed Jesus to deal redemptively with the results of Peter's stupidity. With blood flowing from the side of the servant's head and swords beginning to ring on both sides, Jesus' words freeze the action. And I think he said it loud and I think he said it sternly. Stop! No more of this. And then he reaches towards the gushing wound and touches the servant's ear and heals him. This is one of the great scenes in all the Bible. By the way, John, in his gospel, we don't have it in Luke, but in John's gospel, John tells us his name was Malchus. Imagine Malchus. You know how you touch your ear? You ever gotten like nicked your ear or something? You don't like grab your ear. You just kind of gingerly touch your ear. Is it okay? I just can see just Malchus. Here's my question. This is the kind of things I think about. And I sit in my study, you know. Was it the old ear? Or was it a new ear? You know what I mean? Like, was it the old ear made new? Or was it a new ear? I don't know. If you know, let me know. I'm interested. But Jesus doesn't just reach out to one of his enemies. Here he heals him. It goes beyond just reaching out. You have to wonder, what kind of impact this had on Malchus? I mean, you imagine, you know, by the way, I should tell you this. Some people believe that the fact that John, in his gospel, identified Malchus by name tells us that the early church knew this guy. It's like John says, hey, by the way, that was Malchus. Why would they know him? Why would they know him? Because he had become a believer. I would too if he gave me a new ear. But maybe Malchus became a believer. You imagine, you know, like Malchus is in this church. You go out for coffee time. Hey, Malchus, how you doing, man? You kind of like... I mean, I wonder if they look the same, the two ears, you know what I mean? But just imagine having that dude in your church. You know, coffee time with Malchus. It'd be great. But it wouldn't surprise me if he became a Christian. That's what happens when we become instruments of healing rather than instruments of revenge. Remember what Jesus said to us in the Sermon on the Mount? He said, listen, anybody can be nice to their friends. That's what everybody does. Try being nice to your enemies. And that's when the world's going to take notice, because nobody does that anymore. When things seem so out of control, Jesus maintains control. He can even reach out and heal an enemy because he knows. And he trusts that hell's hour will soon become heaven's hour. And you know what? Genuine Christ followers have been doing the same thing ever since. And that's what sets us apart. Maybe some of you have seen the excellent documentary that has come out this year called Beyond Gates of Splendor. It's a film that tells the story on the 50th anniversary the true story of five American missionaries who were killed in January of 1956. And they were speared to death in the jungles of Ecuador by the Alca Indians. And many of you know this story well. You've perhaps read the book Through Gates of Splendor or one of Elizabeth Elliot's other books about this. But they were speared to death in the jungles of Ecuador by the Alca Indians. The Alcas call themselves, by the way, the Waldanis. And at first, the five missionaries had found acceptance, initial acceptance amongst the Alcas. But eventually, they experienced fierce hostility as a result of their fear, of the fear of the Waldanis. In a testament, though, to God's transforming love, family members of the slain missionaries actually returned to live amongst the Waldani tribe, ministering to the very people who had killed their loved ones. This pattern of not just reaching out, but bringing healing, bringing new life to those who are trying to kill you, started right here as Jesus reaches out to both Judas and to Malchus. I want to show you a scene from that movie because it's so powerful. But in this scene, Kathy and Nate Saint, who are the children, Kathy and Steve Saint, who are the children of Nate Saint, one of the men who was killed by the Alcas, by the Waldanis, they tell the story, Stephen and Kathy, of their own baptism. And the amazing thing is, they chose to be baptized by the very Alcas who had killed their father. I want you to see this.